Before it was a place, it was an idea. A single, shining notion. Today, it is many places in one. Home to both the traditional and the trendy, Fairhope, Alabama, a town of 15,000 on the eastern shore of Mobile Bay, is both a small southern town and an increasingly wealthy resort and retirement community, attracting people from all over America and sometimes called Alabama's Carmel by the Sea. But at its birth, it was neither. Instead, it was about the search for an ideal, a vision for the society and for each member of it. Now, amidst the slow-paced southern charm, live the descendants of zealous northern reformers who came with what they called a fair hope of success for building an American utopian community. Unknown to most, the experiment continues. One of the first things anyone notices about Fairhope is its large public bayfront park. People flock to it from surrounding towns, where private ownership has restricted waterfront access. Technically, much of Fairhope's prime residential area is communal property as well. The idea comes from 19th century economist Henry George's notion that since land is the most finite resource, it should belong to everyone, and that rent for the use of that land should be the only tax. This so-called single tax was intended to reward labor over landed wealth and to create a more equitable and democratic society.
Artisans, free thinkers, all sorts of types came to Fairhope because of the...
It is the legacy of Fairhope's founders. At the turn of the 20th century, the colony created by this small band of Midwestern visionaries became a mecca for political and educational reformers, artists, intellectuals, and nonconformists of all sorts. With a vibrant atmosphere of experimentation, rare if not unique in Alabama history. But this is not a story about a quaint remnant of the past.
Single tax office, this is Daniel.
The Utopia's founding organization still exists, making Fairhope, by some accounts, the oldest surviving secular model community in America. Now in a rapidly changing culture, it struggles to define what remains of its original ideals and to apply them to a world at the turn of a new century. By the time of Fairhope's founding, the eastern shore of Mobile Bay had been a recreational area for hundreds of years, first used for that purpose by Europeans when the British built a recuperation camp here in 1763. The Grand Hotel in Point Clear was built before the Civil War, amid private summer homes, where wealthy Mobilians came to escape the heat. Fairhope's founding father had never seen the ocean. Ernest Berry Gaston grew up in Iowa, where his restless and somewhat mischievous childhood did little to enhance his father's standing as a Church of Christ minister. At the age of 21, he enrolled at Drake University in Des Moines, and after graduation, married and stayed on in the nearby suburb of University Place, where he invented a snowplow, was elected Justice of the Peace, and started a career as a real estate developer. But he also developed a social conscience.
One of the most fascinating questions one can try to answer about people is why do they step outside the magic circle? That is, some people are born into a society where they have privilege, advantages, and so on. And personally, things can be working out for them very well. But they decide that they don't want to stay safe and secure within that circle. They want to break outside of it and restructure the society in which they live. And he decided that.
In the late 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, now in full bloom, was transforming American life, but not only for the better. The marvels of expanding economy and technology were the talk of the day, but so were their byproducts, monopoly, the abuses of wealth and power, and the growing disparity between capital and labor, rich and poor. For the increasingly well-educated middle class, reform became a growing concern. For E.B. Gaston, it became a near obsession.
He read and read and read. He worked himself toward an understanding of America that few people, relatively few people, had. And he wanted to change things.
As a result, in the midst of success, the 28-year-old husband and father abruptly disavowed real estate on moral grounds and became a journalist and reformer. Gaston joined the staff of the Des Moines Farmers Tribune in 1891 and the 1892 populist presidential campaign of its owner, General James Weaver. The effort won Weaver over 1 million votes and became the high watermark for the populist party. But for Gaston, it was not enough.
He was also an ambitious person. He was a person who wanted to achieve, to create, to lead. And he decided that the political process would take too long to bring about the change that he wanted. And he was very keen to do something in his lifetime.
In 1889, Gaston had formed what he called the Des Moines Investigative Club to survey the movement for political reform. For 5 years, he and colleagues would go on an intellectual and moral odyssey of ideas about a better society. They were intrigued by the cooperative ideals of the contemporary socialist Edward Bellamy, but concerned about their practical acceptance. That led them to Henry George, an economist who was very nearly elected mayor of New York in 1886. George was a nationally known figure due largely to his signature work, Progress and Poverty, published in 1879.
Millions of copies of his books sold in the late 19th century. Progress and Poverty was an enormously influential book.
George was a capitalist, but believed that its flaw, the gap between rich and poor, was caused primarily by land ownership concentrated in the hands of the few who hoarded it to increase its value, and in the process made it unavailable to the many. The rightful profit, he maintained, came not from the efforts of the owners, but from the growth of the community as a whole.
George came to say that the solution was the solution to the problem of poverty amidst progress was to make land common property.
One way to do this, wrote George, was to lease the land and return all land value increase to the community as rent, but to levy no other tax whatsoever on improvements or labor. For Gaston and his cohorts, this seemed to be the best marriage of individual incentive and the collective spirit, and he was impatient now to put it in practice. Utopian experimental communities were common in the period. George himself did not support them.
He believed that a model community with a single tax as its centerpiece would fail. And in failing, it would discredit the idea. He believed that the best way to forward his ideas would be through the political process.
Gaston remained undaunted. On January 4, 1894, he called a meeting of the society, presented a plan, and within a month drew up a constitution for a community based on equality of opportunity, individual rewards, and cooperation in matters of general concern. Borrowing both from George and the socialists, he called the system cooperative individualism. Grounded on what they saw as sound principles and thorough study, group members looked forward, they declared, to a fair hope of success, and referred to themselves thereafter as Fairhopers. To inform the present followers and attract new ones, they founded a newspaper, the Fairhope Courier. They had everything they needed for a colony, except a place to put it. In the spring of 1894, James Belangi took a tour of the South. a former math professor, avid populist, single taxer, and one of Gaston's earliest, most trusted cohorts. Belangi was looking for a colony site. He concentrated on the south because of good weather and cheap land. The site in Arkansas was airless and stuffy. The one in Texas was too hot. Lake Charles, Louisiana was full of mosquitoes, and the land in Mississippi was too expensive. When they arrived in Baldwin County, Alabama, Belangi wrote Gaston, "It is lovely indeed. High banks and sandy beach, with every here and there a spring. The view from the shore is magnificent." And he added, "Land back away from the bay can be bought for 50 cents an acre." November 1894. Gaston and his family are among the 28 from seven states preparing to leave all they have known behind. He is a week away from his 33rd birthday and 2 weeks from his 7th wedding anniversary with Clara Mershon. They will be joined by 4 children, all under the age of 5. Six days later, after a train trip to Mobile, the group boards a paddle wheel steamer, the James Kearney, bound for the eastern shore. It is a sunny day with a little haze. There is a light breeze blowing out of the north. It is a temperate 62 degrees. The party is in high spirits. The bay was a source of keen delight, Gaston would remember, especially to some of us from far inland who had never seen salt water. If moved by the profound, they were now faced with the practical, building a city in the wilderness. Strangers to each other, nonconformists in an alien culture of conformity, and with no agricultural skills whatsoever, they went to the task. Within 6 weeks, they had built 2 houses for Ernest Gaston and his mother-in-law, a tool shed and a general store. The store, located at the present-day central downtown intersection, lies near the eastern boundary of the colony's initial land purchase, 135 acres of prime real estate, including a half mile of bayfront, for a price of $6 an acre. Despite its value, this plot was far short of the 15,000 acres called for in Gaston's plan, but which a handful of idealists of modest means could scarcely afford. A sizable donation by soap manufacturer and Henry George admirer Joseph Fells helped finance the purchase of additional outlying land, but large tracts in the Central District would remain in private hands. From the founder's point of view, this would prove an ominous fact and a perennial problem. Even among the colonists themselves, Gaston's cooperative individualists, there was from the start a certain tension between those two impulses. Decisions were made in town meetings where the members referred to each other as brother, but self-interest was always a consideration. The general store first opened as a cooperative, complete with its own money, but quickly reverted to standard retail exchange. Few were cooperating with the cooperative. But other common ventures were exemplary. The colony used single tax funds to construct a wharf, which provided a source of considerable income for 3 decades. The colony-owned steamer Fairhope was equally successful. By 1907, the community had the only central waterworks system in Baldwin County, and a publicly owned phone system on which the calls were free. Soon the colony was attracting attention. In 30 years, the community of 1,500 would be the largest in Baldwin County. People were attracted largely by the free land. It was part of the official welcome, greeting new arrivals at the wharf. And so was a warning to the enemies of the cause. The growing colony was also attracting new settlers interested in its principles. So began the Fairhope reputation as a community of artists, idealists, intellectuals, and simple, unadorned eccentrics. There was a drama club, a Shakespearean beachfront troupe, a nudist colony. Dozens of discussion groups and debating societies filled the meeting halls or gathered beside the bay. The Progressive League, the Fairhope School of Philosophy, the Woman Suffrage Association, the Fairhope Socialist Local.
Every imaginable kind of discussion group in Fairhope. But they were mostly aggressively questioning and searching white Anglo-Saxon Protestants.
One issue that the colonist did not confront was that of race. Contrary to his own principles, Gaston had decided from the beginning that the struggling band of outsiders faced enough obstacles without confronting the prevailing system of segregation.
I'm sure he feels correctly that if the colony were open to black people, that the surrounding population would be so hostile to that act that the colony would fail. It would be closed down. It could not succeed as a racially integrated colony. So he took that, I think, as a given, that that couldn't happen. He knew it was wrong.
Early colony records reveal another striking irony. The original purchase included land where a former slave, Nancy Lewis, had lived since emancipation. Without clear title, she was exiled from a colony founded on equal opportunity. Shortly thereafter, E.B. Gaston made it possible for Lewis to buy land on Fairhope's south side. This helped to establish the predominantly black community which remains there today. But it would also imply to later generations that Jim Crow practices were not inconsistent with Fairhope's essential philosophy.
Well, they were. But people over time get used to a situation. And they think that that's normal, that's natural, that's, you know, that's the way Fairhope is. Well, it was a contradiction from the beginning.
If the colony did not practice its progressive principles with regard to race, in the matter of gender, it was exemplary. Women were on the Single Tax Corporation's governing board from the start and had full political rights in Fairhope long before national suffrage. A large percentage were professional women involved in the suffrage movement and equally with men in the full political and philosophical life of the community. In fact, perhaps two of the three most influential figures in Fairhope's formative years would be female.
And there are cartoons, caricatures of the founders of the Fairhope Single Tax Colony, and Marie Howland is included.
Even in a town of unconventional women, she stood out. Far from the professional stereotype, Fairhope's first librarian was also a free love advocate who was fond of skinny dipping in the bay.
The whole basis of this of the single tax colony was freedom, you know, people to do and be what they are. And she fit right in.
Marie Howland had come to Fairhope from an even more radical utopian community in Mexico. The 62-year-old widow had already lived an exceptional life. A self-educated New England cotton mill worker, she had joined a literary circle that included Walt Whitman and had even performed on the New York stage. In 1874, to good reviews, she published a novel about a woman in a utopian community which was literally banned in Boston for its frank acknowledgement of sexuality. In Fairhope, she wrote frequently as the associate editor of The Courier and further championed women's rights as a primary tenet of the editorial policy. Not long after her arrival, she moved 1,200 volumes from her personal collection to a house next door and gave Fairhope a public library before there was one in Mobile.
We will now proceed with the unveiling.
But it is another woman who, more than anyone,